It's Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And we're starting off the year, the new year, with, of course, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, obviously, we're all going to say Happy New Year to the audience. This is the first program of the year. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon to good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
And so what is the topic today?
Well, Lockwood, let's start off with how does one contest a last will and testament? Oh. How does one challenge a last will and testament? We have a lot of experience in this area. And I think just to begin with, let's kind of recall the elements of what it takes to make a last will and testament, known as testamentary capacity. What is the capacity that we need to have, and what is the capacity that Wes and I need to discern from a client when they're in our office signing a last will and testament? Mm-hmm. And in the state of North Carolina, there are basically four elements, and they haven't really changed, my goodness, in, probably in 100 years or more. I mean, these were the four elements on the bar exam when I took it, you know, many years ago, and right. The same with Wes. So here they go. Let's just outline these real quickly. Number one is to comprehend the nature of the natural objects of your bounty. That one always gets a little laughter. What in the world do you mean by the natural objects of your bounty? Well, basically, you mean your family. Mm-hmm. Does the signer of the will generally know who his family is or who her family is? Mm-hmm. What are the details of that? Just yesterday, I had a very older lady. Actually, she was brought to the office by her family from a nursing facility, a skilled care facility, and, of course, in a wheelchair. That, of course, immediately kind of puts a lawyer on notice. My goodness, let's kind of talk to this lady a little bit about her capacity. And in asking her how many children she had, she told me that she had had two children, and she was able to tell me that. And then she said that one of her children has died, but he adopted a child. And I don't know where that child is. That child is, I've never seen that child, or haven't seen that child in 30, 40 years, meaning her grandchild.
Right.
And so, you know, Lockwood, that's a lot coming from a 92-year-old, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's this element that we're speaking of right now, being that she was able to communicate that. My goodness, in this world, she gets a check mark on knowing the natural objects of her bounty.
Right.
All right, the next element is understanding the kind and nature of your property. You know, is it land? Is it a home? Is it a house? Is it a farm? Do you have bank accounts? Now, you don't have to know your account numbers, and you don't have to know the balances in your bank, and you don't have in the bank accounts, and you don't have to know the balances in even your stock accounts. Mm-hmm. But you need to know, as the element says, the nature and extent of your property. You know, just a general outline of that is sufficient without having to go into details. It's to be expected. The law expects that a 92-year-old, like, say, this woman yesterday, she might, you know, forget that she's got, you know, a CD at a certain bank.
Right.
But in general, this lady was aware of the fact that she had a bank account and which bank it was, and that in her opinion, there were no stocks or bonds in her name.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I was able to give her a check mark for knowing the nature and of her property. By the way, a lot of detail here, but she knew about her home, and she knew that her home was given to her by her mother.
Okay,
in the promised land of Warhead City.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely knew some history with regard to her home place. The third element is know, in effect, how, what they desire. The act of making the will to be, and lastly, that the effect of signing the document. In other words, do they understand that the effect of signing the will is to pass this home place to their child or grandchild or whatever their intention is? Do they understand the effect of the document that they're about to sign? And so these, Lockwood, to begin this afternoon, these are the basic elements. And so a litigator like Wes is going, every case in relative to a will contest or a challenging of a will is going to begin with, you know, let's talk about these four elements. And then, of course, we kind of move from there in terms of the development of how to challenge a will. And I'll let Wes kind of take over right now. But I know, Wes, that you agree that each and every case that you've ever handled begins with an analysis of these four elements.
Right. Well, normally the will caveat cases are going to be an elderly person in most cases who has signed a will, and we're dealing with it, obviously, after the person has passed away, Lockwood, because, in many cases, the family doesn't know what the will, anything about the will, until after the person passes away.
Right.
And then when they pass away, there is, there's a light that is reflected on that because of the fact that you can't be in the shadows anymore.
Right.
Because when the person dies, it becomes public record. Because it's put on record as part of the probate process, and the family or anybody can go take a look at it.
Right.
So, that in many cases we're dealing with, the circumstances under which this will was signed. We're looking at, obviously when it was signed. Was this a will that was printed off the internet and signed without an attorney involved? Who are the witnesses to the will? How does the will disperse the assets? Obviously, is this consistent with what, we understood the wishes of the decedent or testator, the person who died with the will?
So
when we're talking about these elements, I mean, you're normally categorizing these into two things. These elements go into the category of, did the person, as Cecil indicated a moment ago, have testamentary capacity at the time that he or she signed the will? And that's important. It's at the time of the signing of the will, of course. That makes sense, but that's important.
Quick question for you
This
one, related to the capacity of the
testator.
What would you call them? The creator of the will?
The testator. The decedent,
In those capacities as the witnesses, are they privy to the conversation, as you were just sharing with us earlier, Cecil, about the four elements? Are they there to hear the comments and responses from the testator, or is that done between the attorney and the individual, the client?
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. They're not required to be privy to that conversation or overhear conversations with regard to, kind of the interview as it relates to the person's capacity. Sometimes, they just come in and watch the person sign. That's all that's required, either that they watch the individual sign while in their presence and then they sign while in the presence of the testator, or they sign as witness that the testator has acknowledged that they did in fact sign the document. So there's some detail with regard to that.
All right.
So they don't have to be there. So, the last one I've done, I've got a lot of these that I've done over the years and have some that are pending now.
Mm-hmm.
It was done at an attorney's office. It's a small law firm. And so the meetings with the client, with the decedent, took place between the attorney and the decedent, and the, person that we thought was, frankly, unduly influencing the decedent. And then this attorney didn't have, you know, paralegals and secretaries. It was a very small law firm, so she ended up calling in a couple people from local businesses to simply just do that, watch the will being signed.
All right.
Which is fine, but they can't then testify about whether there was confirmation regarding his capacity because they weren't around that took place.
All right. The question I have, and we're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins and Wes Collins. I'm sorry, Cecil and Wes. That was Wes just a few moments ago, about the issue of the will and the topic of contesting the will. I do want to remind you, of course, if you're listening to the program, don't hesitate to reach out and make a call to the offices of Harvell and Collins. And by the way, that number, very easy, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. Wes, back to our topic of the issue of contesting the will and the fact that there are no necessarily guarantees that the witnesses have seen the process of asking those four questions that Cecil articulated earlier. Is that sometimes an issue of contesting or challenging a will?
Yeah, I mean, we really get into the weeds with regard to that because, you know, you would anticipate that when there is an execution of a will that there may be some process of asking questions to determine whether they have the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes there are questions regarding that and sometimes there aren't questions regarding that. You know, sometimes, you know, let's say that the attorney who is involved in the will, if there is one, I mean, obviously, if we're contesting the will and we're wanting to set the will aside, we like to see that there was no lawyer involved.
Right.
You know, that's a check in our box.
Right.
Okay. Right. So why did you go about doing it this way and didn't have an attorney involved? But in the event an attorney's involved, you know, in many cases, you know, we're able to see. And the attorney, I've never seen a situation where an attorney prepares a will, has the client sign the will, witnesses are there, and then when there's a will caveat, the attorney just gives up and says, no, they didn't have capacity. They don't do that.
Right.
I don't care if they did or didn't have capacity. They're going to support their document.
Right.
I mean, that's just what I've always seen in 20-some years. So,
however, I think, Lockwood, what you're hinting at here is that it is not up to the witnesses or the notary, I might add, because not only are wills needing to be witnessed, but it's certainly wonderful when they can also be under notary because that self-proves the document. But you're hinting at the question of, well, do the witnesses have to discern the testamentary capacity? Do they have to, you know, listen to the testator, and do they ask questions, and, you know, are they there for this purpose? And the answer to that question is no.
Wow.
The witnesses are there to attest to the signature, and certainly in the litigation, the witnesses can have an opinion as to what they witnessed and what they saw. But a routine signing of a will does not include going through these four testamentary capacity elements with the signer of the will, the testator, and the witnesses.
We have a testator who, and as you mentioned a moment ago, Wes, most of the times this is happens after, well, obviously I say most, I can imagine all the time, happens after the death of the creator of the will. You have these four questions that you've asked, the four testamentary capacity, checking the testamentary capacity of the creator. If the attorney is not there, and this has happened in the past where the attorney dies, who's to say this individual actually had the capacity?
Well, we dig into different areas. I mean, obviously, one of the things that we do when we're dealing with the capacity issue is, I mean, from the outset, we're going to talk very closely with the family and see what mm-hmm. they say with regard to the person's capacity. At that point in time, I mean, was there a dementia presentation? Was he forgetful?
Right.
Was he or she, you know, at a point where there was in-home health care? Was he still driving? Was he still paying his bills? You know, what medication okay. was he on? Those kind of things. Who are his medical providers? We're going to conduct discovery, as we've talked about on the program before, which would be interrogatory. These are written discovery requests, just put it that way, in very general. Mm-hmm. Interrogatories, requests for production of documents, requests for admissions. We're going to get a HIPAA authorization relative to the medical records, and we're okay. going to get all of his medical records around the time so that we can see what was going on with him at the, you know, when he or she was being provided medical care.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of times that kind of is the,
wow.
That's the, you know, the real mic drop moment.
I
when the medical records indicate that he's, you know, had a mini mental state examination at the medical examiner and made an 8 on it, 8 out of 30 or something like that.
Right.
I mean, you just don't know until you get those things. Ooh. Sometimes, as I was saying before, I mean, we also get the notes of the attorney mm-hmm. from the meeting and get their file, and sometimes we see that the notes are really not very complete at all. Sometimes we even find mistakes in the notes. Sometimes we find that there was a failure of the person who signed the will to identify assets or properly identify the family sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we see that there is, the attorney thinks that they may have gotten everything down, but there's things that were missed. So you can tell it's not just you know, go to the next door neighbor and ask how Joe was doing. You know, there's evidence out there in the world that we utilize that's more of a documentary type thing, medical records, you know, obviously information from the meeting with the attorney, that type of thing, that you know, help us to develop our position with regard to, you know, lack of capacity. And sometimes, you know, obviously we find that through the process that the individual did appear to have capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine too. But, you know, we've just got to chase the evidence and develop the case based on the evidence. The other aspect of this, as I was saying before, is that in many cases we're dealing with folks who are elderly.
Right.
And kind of a second issue, but just as important, is undue influence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the event we have someone who has been under the influence of someone else, and as a result of that influence, signed the will, then that's another basis upon which the will can be set aside.
Right.
You see, there's a correlation between the two, though, because the weaker the person is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe also to say that the more elderly the person is, the more dependent the person is, then the more likely it is that they would be subject to influence, because weaker individuals normally are not able to either discern or able to stand up to the influence as, you know, someone with full capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an overlap there.
You know, that leads me to the other question here. In just a moment, I'm going to remind everyone, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and that was Wes right then. We're talking with about the issue of challenging a will, and we talked about the initiation, and we're going to get to repeat this here in a few moments, Cecil, the four elements of testamentary capacity. But, you know, Wes, the question then goes to the issue of undue influence. And again, I guess that requires some forensic effort on the case of the attorneys representing a challenger. But it also, I'm wondering, represents sort of a necessity on the part of the testamentary, am I correct in that description, the creator of the will, the owner
right.
of the
testator.
Yeah, testator, that they need to go through the process to make sure that when this will is read, that it's clearly understood that, one, they had the capacity, but two, they were doing so of their own free will. That's pretty right. important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very important. And, you know, a case I handled recently, the two witnesses who signed the will, there was a statement in the document that indicated that the person was acting under his own free will. There was no lack of capacity, so on and so forth. And during the discovery process, we actually were able to turn up an email. Actually, it was a text message where the person that we say was unduly influencing the person who signed the will had indicated basically her plan to take this person from his long-standing attorney to another attorney and try to get him to sign documents to leave her more. And so once I put that text between this person and her daughter, and this, then all of a sudden the perspective of the two witnesses and the attorney changed.
Wow!
Because they then said, "Well, if I'd known about this, I would have done things differently. This is what I would have done. I don't know if he would have had capacity. You know, I didn't know this was going on behind closed doors." So, I can't even really think back, Lockwood, on a caveat case or a caveat-related case over the – I can't even think of one where we're challenging a document where we were not able to find some really good evidence in doing our job properly in developing this. Now, we don't just willy-nilly file caveat cases because you cannot set a will aside based on – only a dislike for how the will left assets.
Right.
It has to be based on lack of capacity, undue influence, or it could be a there could be a formal issue with the will. Like, let's say, you know, I was able to prevail on a caveat case one time because we were able to determine that the witness who indicated that they witnessed the document actually wasn't in the room and didn't see it signed.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury came back for us on that, and that just completely nullified the will because they didn't have two witnesses. So, you know, it starts really from an attorney's perspective of
right.
a really, really extensive interview of the family to have a very clear picture as to what really was going on. And if it just doesn't seem like it's there at all with regard to, you know, the basis to set aside a will, well, it's probably not there. But if it, but in my experience, if the family can give me some strong, you know, accurate information about what was going on, and in most of these cases, there's a story.
Right.
You know, there's, you know, everybody's life is a story. then we can take that information and develop it. And at the outset of most caveats, you really don't know, you know, how strong it's going to be until you go through the process and you depose some witnesses and you get those medical records and you start, you know, kind of peeling back the layer of the onion with regard to that. But again, if you have some credible witnesses who appear. And I normally family members who appear to be acting in good faith and not just out of greed, you know, but really think that the person was unduly influenced, lacked capacity, if there's some circumstances under which the document was signed. And normally, as the attorney, you're able to develop that into a successful caveat if you, you know how to do it, number one, if you're diligent in the way you do it, and if you're and if you have the skills to do it, then you normally the story comes together with the evidence is what
right.
I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah. See, I think, Lockwood, that this would be a great topic. We're about out of time for this afternoon. We've just got a couple minutes to continue next time that we talk. I think it would be great to continue this topic because to kind of put it in perspective just today, to get put a more global picture on this, and we haven't even gotten to this, and Wes has not been able to, we've just got not the time to talk about that. The challenge of the will eventually ends up in a proceeding in superior court, mm-hmm. known as a caveat, which, by the way, is a jury trial.
Oh, really?
And the jury then must determine by the standard of civil practice, which is, not the standard of criminal practice, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. That is not the burden of proof. The burden of proof is preponderance of the evidence. It's more likely than not. So the jury has got to determine that by the preponderance of the evidence, the doctors, the witnesses, the lawyer, all of the circumstances in the family, et cetera, that the will was signed under undue influence, or that the testator did not have testamentary capacity. So the reason I'm kind of laying this out at the end is just to put the whole program a little bit in perspective. This is a very significant event to challenge a will. It is not, it cannot be done, it's certainly not something that we do at our office lightly.
Right.
And it is a very involved process. It is intense litigation. It involves all the aspects of litigation that we've talked about on Let's Talk Legal, mm-hmm. depositions, discovery, document discovery, medical records, Department of Social Services records, you name it. Yeah. Wes is going to obtain records from anywhere and everywhere that might shed any light on the case. So it's a very significant proceeding, to quote the topic of the day. How do you challenge a will? It's not something that is lightly entered right. into, and it is a significant event.
You know, it as we come to a close, and by the way, I want you to one more time describe the four elements of testamentary capacity. But, you know, the one thing that comes to my mind on this one, Cecil, and of course we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, is that as we decide that we're going to create wills, and we've talked about this many times before, we need to be very concerned with, we should be very aware of the responsibility of our attorneys in this case. And I think that's an important issue as well. I know we've talked about this on numerous occasions. So as we wrap it up, one more time, Cecil, you started off the program enumerating the issues of the testamentary capacity. What are those four elements one more time for the audience?
Well, the first one is the one that always gets the laugh or the chuckle, yeah. knowing the objects of your bounty. In right. other words, knowing the natural people in your family, your relatives, if mm-hmm. you will, your children, your grandchildren, your mothers, your fathers, things of that nature. Next, the nature and extent of your property. Mm-hmm. Not with particularity, not down to the letter of every number, but you've got to know generally the nature and extent of your property. You need to understand the nature of what you're signing, that it is going to have an effect. That it is a document that is your last will and testament, that it will, in fact, dispose of your property. It will bequeath and devise these assets as you direct, and that the effect of the document is that it will, in effect, dispose of your property. So those are the four elements.
All right. And so those are the comments that we're talking today. And I think it's an important story. I want to thank our program creators, and that, of course, is Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. We were listening earlier to Wes, and then Cecil wrapped it up again with those four elements. I think it's an important issue that possibly consideration for a future program on the actual legal process, the jury trial, and all that's involved in that. I do want to remind the audience, don't hesitate to give them a call, and that is, of course, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and harvellandcollins.com, spell out the word and. And, of course, to remind you, the number, 252 area code, 726-9040, 726-9040. And with that, Wes, Cecil, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Absolutely, Lockwood. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station.